KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. The U.S. military says it plans for every possibility. And in general says the U.S. planned an attack on Iran's nuclear facility for 15 years. But what have senators learned about the results? It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Immigration agents grabbed a landscaper, pinned him down, and punched him as someone took video. Me, Martinez.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. The man is the father of three United States Marines. One of his sons talks with NPR in this hour. Also, doctors respond to decisions by a vaccine advisory committee. Robert F. Kennedy Jr. fired the panel, then named new members who began re-examining vaccines. And Rachel Martin throws Michelle Obama a wild card, asking about her ambitions. It's Friday, June 27th. Fashion designer Vera Wang is 76. The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. The Supreme Court is wrapping up its current term today. NPR's Nina Totenberg reports the justices are expected to issue a number of decisions, including one on birthright citizenship.
The birthright citizenship case is the headliner today, but it's something of a bait and switch. Despite the Constitution's provision guaranteeing citizenship to anyone born in the U.S., President Trump issued an executive order allowing citizenship only for certain individuals. The order was promptly struck down by three separate federal judges, Republican and Democratic appointees alike. The Justice Department appealed to the Supreme Court, but perhaps sensing an almost certain loss on the main question, it has asked the court to stop judges from issuing decisions that apply nationwide. Like this one. If the administration prevails, it will make litigating many of Trump's executive orders far more difficult. Nina Totenberg, NPR News, Washington.
Even if everyone in the country who is eligible to vote did so in the 2024 election, President Trump still would have won. NPR's Domenico Montanaro has more on a study conducted by the Pew Research Center after the election.
Historically, higher turnout was thought to be better for Democrats because younger voters and non-white voters lean left, and they traditionally vote at lower rates. But of the thousands of people that Pew interviewed who didn't vote in the 2024 presidential election, 44% said they preferred Trump, while 40% said they would have rather seen Democrat Kamala Harris in the White House. So even if everyone who could have voted did, Trump's overall very narrow popular vote win would have expanded from 1.5 percentage points to 3. That's a reversal from the last two presidential elections when non-voters said they preferred the Democratic candidates. The finding was part of an almost 9,000-person Pew survey conducted in the weeks after the presidential election. Domenico Montanaro, NPR News, Washington.
Despite a slight increase in oil today, the apparent end to Israel's war with Iran has seen a significant drop in global oil prices over the past week. Villa Marks reports.
The risks of a major new Middle East conflict and its consequences for oil supplies in the Persian Gulf have almost evaporated after the short, sharp exchange of rockets and airstrikes ended in a ceasefire several days ago. The price for oil has fallen significantly in line with the reduced threat to supply from around $80 a barrel in the middle of June after Israel first began targeting Iranian nuclear facilities to around $67 after President Trump announced that ceasefire. The latest weekly price drop of around 12% is the largest fall in more than 2 years as crude oil from Iran and other major producers in the Gulf region have continued to flow unimpeded. Concerns about an Iranian blockade of a major shipping route, the Straits of Hormuz, have proven to be unfounded. For NPR News, I'm Willem Marks.
This is NPR News in Washington. Closing arguments are underway in New York in the trial of Sean Diddy Combs. Prosecutors have spent weeks presenting evidence that the hip-hop mogul is guilty of sex trafficking and racketeering conspiracy. NPR's Isabella Gomez-Sarmiento reports.
Prosecutor Christy Slavik spent hours connecting the dots between all of the victims' crimes and evidence presented to the court for the last month and a half. Slavik explained to the jury that in order to convict Combs of sex trafficking, they need to believe he sexually coerced each alleged victim once. She detailed numerous times Combs' ex-girlfriends testified that they felt pressured by Combs to participate in encounters with male sex workers. Slavik also listed off examples of 8 crimes that fall under racketeering conspiracy. They include arson, kidnapping, and bribery. Jurors need to believe Combs and his employees agreed to commit two of those crimes to convict him. Isabella Gomez-Sarmiento, NPR News.
NASA says that a mysterious fireball that was spotted across several southern states on Thursday was a meteor. The agency says that it entered Earth's atmosphere, streaking across the skies at nearly 30,000 miles per hour before exploding over Georgia. The flash and loud boom were reported in at least six states, including Alabama, the Carolinas, and parts of Florida. Experts are looking for fragments and hoping to learn about more where it came from. Stocks across Asia close mixed today on Wall Street. Dow futures are trading higher at this hour. I'm Windsor Johnston, NPR News, in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Melville Charitable Trust, committed to ensuring all people have a safe, stable, and affordable home that allows them to thrive. Information about ways to prevent and solve homelessness is at MelvilleTrust.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep in Washington, D.C.
And I'm A. Martinez in Los Angeles, California. The Trump administration has revealed a number of new details about U.S. airstrikes on Iran's nuclear program.
The president's top military advisor described an operation many years in the making. And at the end of those years, he said B-2 pilots put giant bombs on the target and returned safely. At the same briefing, the defense secretary attacked the media, but officials did not give much clarity on exactly how much damage the attack did to Iran's nuclear program.
For more, we're joined by NPR national security correspondent Greg Myrie. Greg, so are we any closer at all to knowing how much damage was done to Iran's nuclear program?
Well, we're learning more, but we still don't have a clear assessment. And it's probably not realistic to expect one at this point. All the evidence presented by the Trump administration shows the U.S. airstrikes hit their target Sunday at three separate nuclear sites south of Iran's capital, Tehran. But President Trump just got way out ahead of everyone by immediately saying the Iranian program was completely wiped out. There just doesn't appear to be enough intelligence yet to make such a definitive statement. Secretary of State Marco Rubio, Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth, and CIA Director John Ratcliffe briefed senators on Capitol Hill Thursday. A number of senators emerged and said it's just too early to tell the full extent of the damage.
And there was also that Pentagon briefing that Steve mentioned earlier, Greg, where we heard about how long the U.S. Has been tracking developments at the most important nuclear site, Fordo. So tell us about the briefing.
Yeah, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, General Dan Kane, said the U.S. detected Iran's work on the mountain in Fordo early on. So way back in 2009, the military selected a couple officers with the Pentagon's Defense Threat Reduction Agency to work on this full time.
For more than 15 years, this officer and his teammate lived and breathed this single target, Fordo. He watched the Iranians dig it out. He watched the construction, the weather, the discard material, the geology, every nook, every crater. They literally dreamed about this target at night when they slept.
And this was extremely sensitive and secretive work. They couldn't discuss it with family or friends. They just kept grinding away all these years with all the twists and turns involving Iran's nuclear program.
So what problems do they see?
Well, they came to realize the U.S. didn't have a weapon that could reach a target this deep inside a mountain, perhaps 300 feet down. So Kane said they collaborated with munitions experts, and the result was this 30,000-pound bunker-busting bomb known as the Massive Ordnance Penetrator.
They tested it over and over again. They accomplished hundreds of test shots and dropped many full-scale weapons against extremely realistic targets for a single purpose: kill this target at the time and place of our nation's choosing.
And that time and place came Sunday in Iran.
Okay, so it seems like information is trickling in. What are we learning, though?
Iran's foreign minister, Abbas Araghchi, said his country's nuclear facilities suffered serious damage, but he didn't provide details. And Rafael Grossi, the head of the UN's nuclear watchdog agency, the International Atomic Energy Agency, also said he believes there was significant damage, but he doesn't think the entire nuclear program was destroyed. Now, a big question is the whereabouts of 900 pounds of highly enriched uranium. Did Iran hide that somewhere before the U.S. attacks? Well, Grossi said Iranian officials told him they did take protective measures for that uranium, which could be used for a bomb eventually.
All right, that's NPR's Greg Myrie. Greg, thank you.
Sure thing, eh?
Okay, Greg mentioned a briefing for senators. Democratic Senator Tim Kaine of Virginia was in it. He is on the Senate committees that oversee the military and foreign relations, and he's with us once again. Senator, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
What impression did you come away with about the level of damage to Iran's nuclear program?
Steve, it was entirely a classified hearing, and so obviously I'm not going to talk about classified information, but I think if you look at the combined public statements that these officials have made, that the Iranian foreign minister has made, that the IAEA has made, and that Israel has made, the bottom line conclusion is severe and significant damage to Iranian's nuclear program, with details still coming out. But severe and significant damage would be the fair way to characterize this.
I appreciate that, and that doesn't seem inconsistent with the Defense Intelligence Agency report that NPR has reported on and others have reported on, that said with low confidence, as they put it, that the military hit Fordo, that they did some damage, but that the Iranians might have moved uranium elsewhere just in time. Is that report that the White House has criticized, in fact, a decent bottom line for what the government knows at this point?
Steve, again, that report is classified. I read it in a classified setting, and I don't really want to talk about it. But let me just put it in this kind of a context. If the president on Saturday night had said, "We have taken this action and we've caused severe and significant damage to the Iranian nuclear program," you wouldn't have seen all this damage control over the damage for the last few days. The president overstated it in all likelihood. He compared it to Hiroshima and Nagasaki. He put up an insulting and juvenile musical video on his Truth Social account with a bomb, 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 bomb Iran song. And now you've had the Pentagon try to scramble to assuage his ego, yelling at reporters. They had to postpone the briefing that they gave the senators from Tuesday to Thursday. They had to disinvite Tulsi Gabbard from coming because apparently they didn't like what she might have said. They're scrambling because the president has kind of dislocated his own shoulder by patting himself on the back in some ways that are unrealistic. And that segues into the concern that I have. We shouldn't be going to war on the say-so of one person. That's not how the nation goes to war. General Kaine talks about, we will do this at the time and place of the nation's choosing. Mm-hmm. The nation didn't choose that. President Trump made a unilateral decision without notifying, consulting, or getting approval from Congress. In my view, that is just flat wrong, and that's why I filed a war powers resolution to get senators to weigh in on the question of, should the nation be at war with Iran without a vote of Congress? I don't think we should. Some might think we should. We will have that vote later today.
Is the point moot because the president says the operation's over anyway?
Well, if you completely believe that when he says that, there is no chance of any more military action against Iran, Then yes, but I don't think anybody believes that. The president used military action to strike Iran in his first term. He's just expended tremendous, U.S. assets. These massive ordnance penetrators and the Tomahawk missiles are expensive. They take a long time to reconstitute. I don't think anyone should have confidence that the president will not use military action in the future.
You're raising an important point here, Senator, about who in our republic gets to decide if we go to war or commit an act of war. There's a lot we could discuss about that. I want to ask first, though, about the substance. You're criticizing the way the president committed this act of war. But it is a situation where Iran had a nuclear program. It was of grave concern to multiple U.S. administrations and both political parties. And then this situation comes up where Israel had started a war. What would you have done differently if you were the president? What would you have done differently given that Israel had started the war against Iran? Iran does have this nuclear program, and the U.S. did have the available bomb for Fordo, which seems to have been developed just for that purpose.
Steve, there's two things I would have done differently. First, this war really is sort of on Trump's shoulders because he tore up a nuclear deal that was working, that was limiting Iran's nuclear program even more than these bombs have limited it. This was a program that was working not only in the eyes of our allies and the IAEA, but also working in the eyes of Trump's term one cabinet national security team that said, don't tear up this deal. It's limiting Iranian centrifuges, limiting enrichment, limiting nuclear research. We had deep inspections into what Iran was doing. But when President Trump tore that up, Iran raced forward. So number one, preferred diplomacy over bombs. And number two, if Israel wants to start a war with Iran, we will help defend Israel. But we didn't need to join this war. And the Israelis had achieved significant goals against the nuclear program. In fact, the day before President Trump launched these missiles and these bombs, Israel said it had already set the Iranian program back 2 or 3 years. There was no urgency to this. There was nothing that meant the president needed to act without consulting Congress. So I think we shouldn't be at war without Congress, but I also know deeply Virginians, my troops, I'm on the Armed Services Committee, they think being involved in a third war in the Middle East since 2001 is absolutely ridiculous and would suggest that the U.S. hadn't learned the lessons of the past 20 years.
Another quick question about the president and Congress. The White House claims it's going to limit classified information given to Congress from now on because somebody disclosed DIA findings, Defense Intelligence Agency findings that we mentioned earlier that the president didn't like. Did this subject come up in your meeting?
The subject came up only in this way. A member of the Senate asked, are you going to, curtail information to us? And the administration briefers said, no, we are not. But we're still worried about it because the president chose to notify Republican leaders of the strike, but not Democratic leaders. And that is something that no president has done during the time that I've been here. I've been with Democratic and Republican presidents. There's a protocol about who gets noticed. And it's both the Democratic and Republican leaders of the key committees, Armed Services, Foreign Relations, Intelligence, Appropriations.
Are your Republican colleagues sticking up for you and saying national security needs to be bipartisan? It really matters.
I've not heard them. I hope they will. And I think they believe that it should, but I've not heard anybody raise concerns about Democrats not getting information.
Senator Tim Kaine of Virginia, it's always a pleasure talking with you. Thank you, sir.
Steve, great to be with you. Thanks.
NPR invited multiple Republican senators on the program to discuss this intelligence. We're happy to hear them on another day. This is NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, we remember war correspondent Rod Nordland. He was diagnosed with a lethal brain tumor in 2019 and died on Sunday at the age of 75. He talked about facing mortality as a war correspondent and as a patient. And we'll hear from legendary guitarist Buddy Guy, who has a cameo in Ryan Coogler's film Sinners. Join us.
I don't know why in the hell I'm here.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Raymond James, a firm focused on transforming lives, businesses, and communities through tailored wealth management, banking, and capital market solutions. Disclosures at raymondjames.com. From the Kresge Foundation, established 100 years ago, the Kresge Foundation works to expand equity and opportunity in cities across America. A century of impact, a future of opportunity. More at kresge.org. From the Council for Interior Design Qualification, whose certified designers work to protect occupants through the design of code-compliant and accessible environments. Learn more at cidq.org/NPR. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm A. Martinez. A committee that helps craft vaccine policy in the U.S. has become a source of controversy under the leadership of Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. Yesterday, the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices wrapped up its two-day meeting. Here's NPR's Will Stone.
This meeting of advisors to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention was unusually high profile, largely because of Secretary Kennedy's decision to purge the entire panel of experts just a few weeks ago. In their place, his handpicked roster of seven members, some with a history of making inaccurate claims about the safety of COVID vaccines. The chair of the committee, Martin Kulldorff, an epidemiologist who's worked on vaccines, began the meeting with a call to rebuild public trust and an announcement that a new working group would re-examine the childhood vaccine schedule.
The number of vaccines that our children and adolescents receive today exceed what children in most other developed nations receive, and what most of us in this room receive when we were children.
Another group, he said, would look at vaccines that have not been subject to review in more than 7 years. All of this makes Yale professor Jason Schwartz, who studies vaccine policy, very nervous.
They're already signaling their interest in revisiting long-settled questions around vaccine safety, opening up issues that have been focal points of critics of vaccines for decades.
On the second day, a majority of the panel reaffirmed the CDC recommendations that anyone over 6 months get the annual flu shot. Other votes, however, focused on essentially banning flu vaccines with a mercury-containing preservative called thimerosal. Theories that chemical could cause autism have long been disproven. Even so, manufacturers voluntarily removed it from childhood vaccines years ago. It's rarely used in flu shots anymore. And yet, the panel heard a presentation on alleged safety concerns from the former head of Children's Health Defense, a group that Secretary Kennedy founded. It's questioned vaccine safety and spread misinformation. Dr. Cody Meisner, a pediatrician at Dartmouth, was the only panel member to vote against the recommendations.
I'm not quite sure how to respond to this presentation. This is an old issue that has been addressed.
The meeting of the group, called ACIP for short, was at times chaotic. In fact, the American Academy of Pediatrics decided not to attend. Dr. Jim Campbell, who's with the Academy, says they thought there would be no room for real participation, and the votes on thimerosal prove that.
The vote was based on a single talk without any work group or other expert input. That is not the way that ACIP typically works, so we're just disappointed.
And the meeting has raised big questions about the future of vaccine policy for Dr. Andy Pavia, a pediatrician at the University of Utah.
I think hundreds of physicians, epidemiologists, pediatricians watched with some degree of horror.
Pavia points out this panel helped shape insurance coverage of vaccines, and he worries what they decide going forward could ultimately reduce access to them. Will Stone, NPR News.
We have an interview this morning with Michelle Obama. She talked with our colleague Rachel Martin, former co-host of this program, who now hosts Wildcard. She asks her guests deep questions about their lives, which they choose from a deck of cards. and Michelle Obama was her most recent guest. Hi there, Rachel.
Hi, Steve.
It's so great to see you again. So what did you learn about this super, super famous person?
That she very much wants to be in control of her life in a way that she just wasn't able to be when she was first lady, when she was in the White House. And that means getting to say no to things. I mean, you'll remember she did not go to President Trump's inauguration this year. She did not go to President Jimmy Carter's funeral. She's saying what she wants to say, how she wants to say it, especially on this new podcast she's got with her brother. It's called IMO. Mm-hmm. And part of being able to be herself in this new way is setting the record straight when certain rumors start flying about her marriage, they did.
The fact that people don't see me going out on a date with my husband sparks rumors of the end of our marriage.
So that is the apocalypse.
It's the apocalypse. It's like, okay, so we don't Instagram every minute of our lives. We are 60. We're 60, y'all.
Okay, so she's doing what she wants to do. I know you asked her a bunch of questions drawing off these cards. Could we hear one of the answers, please?
Yes. Here's her answer to the question she drew from our deck. Has ambition ever led you astray?
Wow. I don't know if my ambition has ever fully been able to actualize itself because of the nature of what me and my husband have done. I mean, you know, I guess you
as
could
a team.
As a team,
right?
You know,
it wasn't about your individual ambition.
Was it right? It was the team ambition, and I went along, arguably kicking and screaming, right? And as a working mother, I think all of that stuff kind of cut my ambitions short a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because I had to make a set of decisions. Okay, my husband's over here. I've got these kids over here. I don't know if I can afford to be ambitious right now.
Right.
So I think I kind of squelched my ambition. But now is a time for me to embrace my own ambition and to define it for me. So maybe the answer is we'll see.
Yeah.
Because I think I'm just now fully stepping into my own ambition.
Yeah.
Part of ambition in living your own life is saying yes to things you want to do. It's also saying no, I imagine, to things that you don't want to do.
For sure.
Yeah.
And we experienced that. One of the major decisions I made this year to stay put and not attend funerals and inaugurations and all the things that I'm supposed to attend. That was a part of me, you know, using my ambition to say, let me define what I want to do apart from what I'm supposed to do, what the world expects of me. Mm-hmm. And I have to own that. Those are my choices. Whatever the backlash was, I had to sit in it and own it.
Yeah.
But I didn't regret it, you know, but we'll see. Maybe next year we sit down. I go, you know, Rachel, went a little too far.
Our own Rachel Martin speaking with former First Lady Michelle Obama. Rachel, where can people go if they want to hear some more?
Yeah, you can listen to a longer version of that conversation if you search for Wildcard with Rachel Martin in your podcast app. And you can even watch a video of that entire episode on YouTube or Spotify.
Rachel, thanks so much.
Thank you, Steve.
And here's Rachel Martin. This is NPR News.
Steve Aoki has been making electronic music for decades, dominating a genre whose popularity has ebbed and flowed. Well, now when dance music is peaking again, Aoki is sticking to his roots.
I am one of the few people in the EDM space that care about dropping albums.
I'm Ari Shapiro. Steve Aoki's latest studio album on the next All Things Considered from NPR News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly.
The U.S. Supreme Court is expected to hand down the final six decisions of its term today. As NPR's Nina Totenberg reports, those cases include President Trump's effort to end birthright citizenship.
Top billing today goes to the Constitution's guarantee of citizenship for anyone born in the U.S. and President Trump's executive order that would dramatically limit who qualifies for citizenship. But the case will likely turn on an important procedural question. Also to be resolved is whether public school parents have the right to opt their kids out of classes that conflict with their religious beliefs. Then, too, there's another challenge to the Affordable Care Act, a state law that seeks to curb kids' online access to sexually explicit material, and another congressional redistricting case with potential to further erode the Voting Rights Act. Nina Totenberg, NPR News, Washington.
The man charged with shooting two state lawmakers in Minnesota and their spouses is scheduled to appear in federal court today. A hearing will determine whether Vance Belter will be granted bail. He's facing charges that include murder and attempted murder. The bodies of State Representative Melissa Hortman and her husband Mark, who were killed by gunfire, will lie in state at Minnesota's Capitol building ahead of their funeral tomorrow. This is NPR News. Prosecutors in New York delivered closing arguments yesterday in the trial of hip-hop mogul Sean Diddy Combs. He's charged with sex trafficking and racketeering conspiracy. Defense attorneys will make their final arguments in court today. Combs has pleaded not guilty to the charges. New York Mayor Eric Adams has formally kicked off his re-election bid as an independent. He did so 2 days after State Assemblyman Zohran Mamdani became the likely Democratic mayoral nominee. A man convicted of killing 9 people in Japan was hanged today. As NPR's Anthony Kuhn reports, it was the country's first execution in 3 years.
Takahiro Shiraichi was sentenced to death in 2020 for killing 8 women and 1 man. He was also convicted of sexually assaulting the female victims and robbery. Media dubbed Shiraichi the Twitter killer. In 2017, he lured 8 women aged 15 to 26 and offered to fulfill the suicidal wishes most of them had posted on social media. He sexually assaulted them, strangled them to death, took their money, and dismembered them. He also killed one woman's boyfriend to silence him. A Tokyo court rejected the defense's argument that the victims consented to being killed. Surveys show the majority of Japanese support the death penalty, although opposition to it has been growing. Anthony Kuhn, NPR News, Tokyo.
I'm Dave Mattingly, NPR News, in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Nature Conservancy, committed to the belief that nature is common ground for everyone and that protecting nature is vital to solving today's challenges. Learn more at nature.org/NPR. From Amazon Business, offering business buying tools and technology with the goal of simplifying how to stock up to get ahead. Learn more at amazonbusiness.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep in Washington, D.C.
And I'm A. Martinez in Los Angeles, California. The viral and violent arrest of a man in Southern California is raising concerns about the tactics used by Immigration and Customs Enforcement agents during workplace raids. Videos posted online show Nariso Barranco fleeing masked federal agents who then pin him to the ground and strike him multiple times.
I spoke with Alejandro Barranco, Narciso's son. Alejandro is a U.S. Marine Corps veteran. His two brothers are active duty Marines, and he told me what it was like to watch the video of his father's arrest.
I think it was completely unprofessional and uncalled for, like beating a man on the ground, punching him repeatedly in the face. I don't think it represents what our law enforcement officers or anything like that. I was really, really mad when I saw that. I couldn't believe it. The way they treated him, like, so inhumane. I threw my phone on the ground. I couldn't watch it.
Now, the Department of Homeland Security has said on social media that your father, quote, assaulted federal law enforcement with a weed whacker. Mm-hmm. And then Customs and Border Protection posted on X a video of what looks like a person swinging a weed whacker at agents. What do you make of that characterization? Does that sound like something your father would do?
No, of course not. And the movement you see from the weed whacker, I think it's a natural instinct because he had sprayed seconds before that. I think it was just his own body, his own instincts just reacting to that spray.
He was sprayed with what?
I'm not sure what it was, mace, pepper spray, I don't know.
How's he doing? Has he been able to process everything that's happened?
I don't think so. I mean, when he called this morning, he was scared. He said that they were moving him. He didn't know why. I mean, all of this is new to him, obviously. It's just, I can only imagine how he feels right now.
How long has your father been in the United States?
Since the 90s. I want to say at least 30 years.
Yeah. Well, what would you say to someone that says, hey, if you've been in this country decades, you should have found the time to make sure that something like this eventually wouldn't happen?
Yeah. No, I understand that people might think that way, but they also need to understand that everybody's situation is different. My dad worked Monday to Sunday. He was always trying to provide for us, make sure we were all well-fed, well-dressed, provide a roof over our heads. So, I mean, it's clear that his priorities were us so that we can also give back to this country in this way, the way we serve.
Did you have any conversations with him or maybe other members of your family about what was happening in the LA area with ICE and the possibility maybe that your father might be arrested somehow?
We knew these things were happening, these raids were going on. We prepared them. We told them, you know, keep calm, let them identify themselves, don't say anything, don't sign anything, don't fight back. He knew these things were happening and he accepted the fact that it could happen. But what we weren't prepared for and didn't prep him about was these guys attacking him. We never expected anything like that. We expected these guys to act professionally and up to standards on the United States government.
So considering your brothers are active duty Marines, if they are deployed somehow, somewhere in the world to fight for the United States of America, have you figured out how you might square those feelings of putting your life on the line for a country that has done this to a family member?
They know their orders. They know they're supposed to follow orders. And when you're in a situation like that, I do believe you're fighting for those people next to you, not necessarily the country.
What do you think about the Trump administration's approach to people without legal status in the U.S. generally?
I'm not sure they have the right picture because The administration, I believe, I'm not too involved in politics, but I believe they said that they were going after criminals. And from what we've seen, I think it's the complete opposite. I think the majority of people that they're getting are hardworking people who have been here for decades, providing for their family, providing for this country.
Any idea about what comes next for your father?
First and foremost, we want to get him out of there. After that, we'll work on his legal status. But for now, we do want him home.
That's Alejandro Barranco, whose father, Narciso Barranco, was recently detained by ICE. Alejandro, thank you for sharing your story with us.
Yeah, of course. Thank you.
NPR reached out to ICE and the Department of Homeland Security. In a statement, DHS Assistant Secretary for Public Affairs Tricia McLaughlin said that on June 21st, Border Patrol agents arrested a man without legal status who, quote, tried to evade law enforcement and refused to comply every step of the way. She said agents took appropriate action and used minimal force to resolve the situation. McLaughlin added that resisting arrest places those being arrested as well as agents and the community at risk.
The jury in the trial of Sean Combs has heard the final arguments from the prosecution. For several hours, federal prosecutors wove together 7 weeks of evidence and testimony. They hope to prove that Combs is guilty of crimes including sex trafficking and racketeering, all of which he denies. We should advise you, as always, this story contains mentions of violence and alleged sex trafficking. No other way to cover this story. Here's NPR's Isabella Gomez Sarmiento.
Much of the government's case against Sean Combs revolves around the testimony of two of his ex-girlfriends, the singer Cassie Ventura and a woman who testified using the pseudonym Jane. Both women say that for years, Combs pressured them to participate in drug-fueled sexual encounters with male escorts that could last multiple days. Ventura and Jane testified that he used financial control, emotional manipulation, and physical force to get them to comply with what he asked, even when he knew they didn't want to. Both women said that early in their relationship, they agreed to these encounters because they loved Combs and wanted to make him happy. But eventually, they told him they did not want to keep having sex with other men. During closing arguments, prosecutor Christy Slavik detailed multiple specific incidents that she said proved Combs trafficked these women. But in order to convict him of trafficking, she explained, the jury only needs to believe Combs forced or coerced each woman into just one of these encounters. The other major charge is for racketeering conspiracy. That's best known as a mob charge, and Slavik argued that Combs did, in fact, run a criminal enterprise, a close circle of employees doing his bidding. Through text messages and phone records, Slavik tried to prove that some of Combs' employees, including assistants and security guards, were deeply involved in crimes committed on his behalf. They include things like bribery, witness tampering, and distributing drugs. Slavik explained to the jury that if they found Combs and his employees committed at least two of these criminal acts, that amounts to racketeering. She told the jury that Combs, quote, used violence, power, and fear to get what he wanted. She told them now it's time to hold him accountable. Today, Combs' defense will make their case before the jury begins deliberations. Isabella Gomez Sarmiento, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
Before you toss that old tomato, consider using it to grow a new one. A gardener has advice on growing your own groceries next time on Here and Now.
Big news stories don't always break on your schedule. But with the NPR app, news, culture, and podcasts are ready when you want them. In your pocket. Download the NPR app today.
Good morning, I'm Steve Inskeep. Lalo Schifrin has died at 93, the composer who accepted this musical mission. He scored hundreds of shows and films like Cool Hand Luke and Bullet. And all his life, one thing led to another. He grew up in Argentina, then came to America while working with the trumpeter Dizzy Gillespie. He wrote the Mission Impossible theme that we're hearing now. Bruce Lee practiced martial arts to this very song and then asked Schifrin to score his final film. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org. From the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at WaltonFamilyFoundation.org. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm A. Martinez. An HIV-AIDS treatment program created by President George W. Bush is under threat as Republicans in Congress look to cut federal spending. Our colleague Darian Woods from the Indicator podcast examines the legacy of PEPFAR and what it would mean for the program to end.
Not everyone remembers this acutely, but in the 1990s, AIDS was one of the leading causes of death, including in the U.S. And then came game-changing drugs to treat HIV, the virus that causes AIDS. These drugs were what's called antiretroviral therapy. John Cohen is a senior correspondent for Science magazine and has been covering public health for over 30 years.
They could basically allow people who had HIV to live normal lifespans.
Antiretroviral therapy saved millions of lives in wealthy countries.
Well, that wasn't available to most people living with HIV in the world because the drugs were so incredibly expensive, about $15,000 a year per person.
That's what impelled George W. Bush to start PEPFAR. And what's made PEPFAR successful is that the program is heavily monitored for its outcomes. Program managers can look at a country and see where it's succeeding, where it's failing, and what could be changed. And even some of the countries hardest hit by AIDS have reached these targets.
To date, the program has spent over $120 billion and has saved an estimated 26 million lives. It's a phenomenally successful program.
That success is now under grave threat. The hope had been that American assistance could start phasing down around 2030. But some Republican lawmakers didn't like that some money was targeting higher-risk groups like sex workers and LGBT people. So that glide path has now turned more into a crash landing. Earlier this year, many HIV/AIDS organizations in places like Africa received emails terminating their contracts with the USAID. The emails were signed off, God Bless America. White House Budget Director Russ Voigt said the U.S. is in $37 trillion in debt, and at some point the continent of Africa needs to absorb more of the burden of providing this health care. So could African countries fund HIV/AIDS treatment and prevention themselves?
Sure, and they want to, and they're moving toward that. But to think that this is going to solve our debt problem, I mean, come on, do the math. It's more than simply soft diplomacy. It's creating a stable world where you don't have military conflicts, you don't have countries falling apart because of health.
We reached out to the Department of State asking if its leadership was concerned. A spokesperson said PEPFAR continues to support life-saving HIV testing, care, and treatment approved by the Secretary of State. But they also said that other PEPFAR-funded services are currently being reviewed for efficiency and consistency with U.S. foreign policy. John says, like any large system, there were always wrinkles, like leadership in Washington pushing too hard for those metrics sometimes, or debates over abstinence promotion. But overall, he says this was an extremely well-run program. In its hobbled state now, though, researchers from the HIV Modeling Consortium estimated 70,000 people have already died. Darian Woods, NPR News.
Support for Planet Money comes from Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com.
This is NPR News. Thank you.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Amy Martinez.
I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin. All athletes face pressure, but what if that pressure isn't for money, fame, or glory, but just to survive? In the new film Tatami, Iranian government agents order judo athlete Leila Hosseini to fake an injury at the World Championships to avoid facing off against an Israeli athlete. They threaten to harm her family if she doesn't comply. So Leila, like the real athletes who inspired the film, faces an impossible choice: acquiesce to the regime and throw the match, or compete and show the world and herself what she's capable of.
Is Leila a part of this?
It's a team decision.
Well, somebody needs to notify her because she just stepped out into the tatami.
Tatami is the first feature film co-directed by an Israeli and an Iranian. I spoke with Oscar winner Guy Natif and Zahra Amir, who won a Best Actress Award at Cannes. Natif told us how he first came across Amir.
Because I'm not Iranian, I'm not Persian, I wanted to open myself to Iranian talent. And then I saw Holy Spider and my jaw dropped when I saw Zahra's performance. So Zahra auditioned to play Mariam. And I kind of offer her to collaborate, to direct together, to cast the movie, to produce it with me. And she took her time to think about it. And that started a whole beautiful journey for both of us.
Zahra, what made you want to participate in this film? And if you don't mind my asking, why did you hesitate?
Because I was a bit afraid. But then at some point, I just realized that I'm doing as Mariam does in the movie. You know, I'm hesitating.
Well, what you said is very profound there. As well as co-directing, you play Mariam, who is Layla's coach. And so I wanted to ask how you arrived at that balance, I guess, between the physicality and the interiority. Guy, do you want to start?
I think that once we worked together on the script and how to make it very personal and very intimate, together with the physical challenge of just going in there, you know, Ariane Mandy, she's a boxer in real life. And she had 3 weeks of judo training in Los Angeles, and she competed versus real judoka, real judo fighters. So the entire shoot was very physical.
Adrienne Mandy plays Leila. She did all of her own scenes.
Yeah, because she's amazing.
Right, and I was like, my goodness. I understand that you also trained. Why is that? You just wanted to be sure you understood it, or tell me more about that.
You know, yeah, while I was in LA for my Holy Spider movie, I could go and at least watch how this judoka, they work. How is the attitude between, you know, coach and judokas?
Just seeing these amazing women doing their thing physically and emotionally was profound to me.
So, Zahra, let me ask you this. Why are Iranian officials so opposed to Leila fighting in Israeli?
It's Iranian regime political agenda. We need this imaginary enemy. This is the way totalitarian regimes, they survive, especially in Middle East. But it's so absurd. So more and more people, they don't obey.
I also think that in judo, it's a sport that you have to honor your opponent because you have to bow, right? There's a big respect. And the Islamic regime do not want the judoka, the Iranian judoka, to lose to an Israeli, because it's kind of like you have to honor her or him by bowing. And they see that as an insult in a way.
In the film, representatives of the World Judo Association approach her to give her an opportunity to defect. But Leila hesitates at first. Why?
I think it's a very normal and natural reaction, because you put your family, you put your old friends and, you know, your life, your career in danger. It's the biggest decision of your life, as we say in the movie. You know, this is the difference between Mariam and Leila. But Mariam was in the same situation like 10 years ago, and she couldn't make this decision. But Leila, as a new generation, which is a brave generation, and there are histories why we are different. We have different backgrounds. We grew up in war, we grew up after revolution, but this new generation who are our children, you know, they are much more clear about what they want to do.
I understand this may be difficult to talk about, but you also did leave Iran in order to continue to do your work. It's my understanding that after you won Best Actress at the Cannes Film Festival in 2022, you received many threats.
Yeah.
I'm just wondering how this must have informed the way you approached this work.
That's why I know when I do something now, when I do such a movie like Holy Spider or Tatami, It's not just only making a movie. For me, it's so important how we do this movie, how we bring these kind of stories to cinema. And so I don't mind anymore if I get threats or whatever. And I think since I show it that I don't have any fear, I really get less and less threats.
Guy, I understand that you shot this film in secret. And I was just wondering, why did you feel that this was necessary?
Well, both Zara and I got some phone calls from the embassies. I got from the American embassy, Zara got from the French embassy, just warning that we are shooting in Tbilisi, Georgia, which is 2 hours away from Tehran and 2 hours away from Tel Aviv. We had to call this project in a different name. We spoke only English. We were in different hotels, and it was a closed set. So we just wanted to make sure that we are not a target.
Mm-hmm. So before we let you go, it's not a secret that this film arrives at a very tense moment. As part of your press notes, you write, "Ultimately, we hope we have made a film that will show the world that humanity and partnership always win." I want to ask both of you this. Do you really feel that way?
I will go and say absolutely. I feel that collaboration between so-called enemies will heal more. This is our weapon. Make art, not war. We made a film about Iran, but I also feel that, in a way, Israel has become totalitarian.
Hmm. Zara, what about you?
Artists are always kind of mirror of a society. I mean, for me, this collaboration was a window to a new culture, which is not really far from my culture. We started to get to know each other more and more. And finally, it's just like we are sisters and brothers. We like the same music. We like the same food, you know. There is no other way. We have to shake our hands and try to love each other, to understand each other.
Those are the directors Guy Nativ and Zara Amir. Their new film, which they co-directed and Zara also stars in, it's called Tatami, and it's out in theaters now. Thank you both so much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Our theme music was inspired by B.J. Lederman. I'm Michelle Martin.
I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm A. Martinez.